Ég ætla nú bara að segja nokkur orð aðalega til að bjóða ykkur velkominn og taka ykkur til að mæta svona snemma dags á laugardegi þegar maður gæti svo við út. Við erum rosalega ánægð með að halda þetta málþing eins og þið vitið náttúrulega þetta 40 ára afmæli Nílós og málþingið partur af því. Hugmyndin, við erum í raun og veru þessi stjórn að erfa hugmyndina, þetta náttúrulega í hugmyndin búin að vera lengra í vinnslu og það raun og veru stjórnina Þorgerðar sem kom upp með þessa æðislega hugmynd og hún tengist, hún í raun og ná tengd útgáfu sem að vera að vinna að sem við erum að reyna að hamast við að klára listamannaríkin rými. Okkur datt í hug að áhugavert væri í þessu samhengi að fá erlendan gest til að kannski aðeins koma með nýjan reynsluheim inn í okkar umræðu og það Mark Cullen sem frá Palace Projects í Dublin. Þau stóðu fyrir útgáfu listamannaríkin rými Evrópu og hann ætla á eftir að tala aðeins það. Ég ætla nú ekki að segja mikið meira, þið eruð væntanlega með prógramið. Við ætlum að hafa þetta á svona óformlegum og skemmtilegum nótum sem því að ég ætla að hvetja ykkur til að tala, til að spurja, til að taka þátt í umræðu. Það má alveg standa upp þegar maður þreyttur, fá sér kaffi, annars fara út að fá sér ferskloff, bara gera það allir að njóta þess sem mest. Er ég að glemma einhverju, Kolbrún?
Nei,
ok. So Mark, I just said how wonderful you are and what an amazing presentation you're going to give us. I just said a very few words that
so
were
far high.
Yeah, and that's the practicality. So also, you know, if you need coffee, just give me a sign and I'll bring you some coffee. Okay. But otherwise, I would just give the word over to you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dara. thank you very much, Dara, and thank you very much, Nilo, for inviting me here today to speak to you all. It's a real honor to be here, and I'm delighted with the opportunity to talk to you about a publication that Palace Projects published back in 2016. This is it here. I'll go through it anyway, through my slides. It's Artists Run Europe, Practice Project Spaces. It's a part how-to manual, part history and part socio-political critique of the conditions, organizational models and role of the artist-led within artists within contemporary art practice and society. The aim is to show how artist-run practice manifests itself and how artist-run spaces are a distinctive and central part of visual art culture and how they present a necessary alternative or parallel to the art institution, museum or commercial gallery. Artists Run Europe aims to allow a fuller understanding of the characteristics and roles of artist-run spaces, discussing and analysing areas such as what position do artist-run spaces occupy within the field of contemporary art today? Do or should they stand in opposition to museums and commercial galleries, or are they alternatives to other art world structures? How is value ascribed to these often transitory practices, and is this value recognised within the field? How are these spaces organized, and can artist-run spaces develop and be sustained in the longer term without becoming institutionalized? How important, intrinsic, or problematic is the voluntary nature of much artist-run practice? How do artist-run spaces add to the ecology of the civil society? What are the main practical issues or problems faced by artist-run spaces? Does precarity have to be a defining feature? Can recognition of the alternative and specific type of value that artist-run spaces provide allow for a specific approach to the funding and support of these organizations, one that avoids requirements for quantifiable results more suited to museums and larger institutions? What can we say about the future hoped-for trajectories? Alternative and artist-run culture, as we know it today, can be said to have its roots in 1960s and 70s counterculture. This culture that gave rise to a wave of spaces in the 60s and 70s was anti-establishment in its rejection of dominant structures, which either ignored cutting-edge contemporary art, new media art, female artists, experimental and performance art, or were commercial and driven primarily by sales. Crucially, rather than just acting as a movement of individuals, the proponents of this culture of self-determination and collectivization opted to locate themselves as groups in spaces, spaces for production, thought, exhibition, and debate, and spaces which lay outside perceived commercial or cultural zones, both ideologically or often literally situating themselves in rundown inner city areas, which were, like the art forms, largely ignored by commercial, cultural, and political interests at the of the time. The artist-run model and ethos is one which perpetuates alternative and often non-hierarchical modes of organization and economies of exchange, knowledge, and resources. A non-commercial approach to producing art and culture. It supports and develops experimental or unrepresented forms of practice and discourse, and proposes a model of social and cultural interaction that could be seen to eschew the roles of producer and consumer. Artist-run spaces play a vital role in supporting artist practices at early stages of their careers, and often have a key stake, albeit a precarious and not uncontroversial one, in the revitalization of derelict urban areas. The common denominator among many artist-run groups and spaces is that they arise out of a deficit. Something is missing in the cultural landscape. Artists were dissatisfied with or unable to access the established venues, forums, or modes of presentation and convene to create a new kind of space that addresses their needs. In the canon of art history, and also in regular funding streams, artist-run spaces are still a largely overlooked cog within the field of contemporary art practice. Often going under the radar, run on a voluntary basis, and by and large of a transient or precarious nature, with notable exceptions, their importance and value to the wider viability of critically engaged contemporary art and role in sustaining the practices of artists, often in the crucial formative stages, goes largely unremarked. The energy invested in maintaining these initiatives is often used up quickly in the face of a lack of resources, burnout is rife, and a finite ability to maintain activities through an economy of sharing and often free labour. As such, the continued but constantly changing presence and value of the artist-run field of practice is by its nature difficult to quantify and record. This has been redressed, albeit to a small degree, over recent years, and internationally, the subject of artist-led practice is now being seen as worthy of further study and debate, with a number of notable publications largely focused to date in Canada and the USA. Recent examples include Artist-Run Spaces Non-Profit Collective Organizations, Artist-Run Histories, New York Art Spaces, 1960 to 2010, Decenter, Concerning Artist-Run Culture, and the Institutions by Artist publication and conference in Vancouver, to which Self-Organize is a welcome and important addition, looking at the wider role of not just artist-run spaces. Artist-run events such as Artist-Run Festival Copenhagen, Supermarket Art Fair in Stockholm, and Sluice Art Fair in London, who, in using their outward structure of the art fair, something the wider public and funding bodies can more readily understand, have had an impact in drawing together international pockets of artist-run practice, and rather than actually focus on sales, afford artist-run and independent spaces from different countries a locus to meet and connect. More often, the artist-run presence becomes visible in the wider art world only in cases where large institutions and museums have sought to collaborate with artist-run spaces or include them in survey-type exhibitions in order to present a whole picture of a period of the art scene. The exhibition Life Live at the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris, 1996, curated by Hans-Ulrich Urbst and Lawrence Boss, included spaces such as Glasgow's Transmission and London City Racing. For the 2002 Gwangju Biennial in Korea, curated by Wang Kyung-sung, Charles Esch and Hu Han-ru, the inclusion of artist-run spaces suggests Rebecca Gordon-Nesbitt, quote, convert a freedom through stylistic choices that perhaps the curators did not feel able to take themselves. In an attempt to foreground a conclusion in the biennial of 26 artist-run spaces from Asia, Europe, and beyond, Hu Han-ru championed artist-led activity as a counterpoint to pervasive empire, the local influencing the global, end quote. Gordon Nesbitt goes on to cite Charles Esch's Baltic Babel, in which 8 cities were represented through their artist-led initiatives, a project that was, quote, was accompanied by the most explicit understanding yet of the role of artist-led initiatives in local communities and their political potential, end quote. In Ireland, Dublin City Gallery de Hugh Lane invited Palace Studios to curate an exhibition in its main galleries in 2005, for which Palace opted to present artists and international Irish and international artists commissioning new or showing current work as opposed to presenting a survey of our projects to date. Again in Ireland, the model Sligo, under direction of Seamus Keeley, conceived of the exhibition Dorm to relaunch the refurbished galleries in 2010, which featured 21 international and Irish collectives and artist-run spaces, including Palace Projects, Catalyst Arts, Irwin, General Idea, and Rax Media Collective. Other instances have afforded further currency to spaces insofar as presenting current work, if in some cases not paying them at all. Tate Modern's highly unconventional celebration of its first decade, No Soul for Sale, a festival of independence, is perhaps the most high profile and large scale of these, with over 70 groups contributing, yet was deeply problematic in not paying any of the contributors, and according to Steen Herbert in Self-Organized, quote, received harsh criticism for its barely concealed exploitative undertones, end quote. She goes on to point out, however, quote, that most of the participants so readily accepted these terms demonstrated an important lesson about how the institutional art world sustains itself. In his essay on deorganization, Barney Drabble points to the structural diversity of the artist's run. The diversity of descriptive terms alone reminds us just how broad a spectrum of activities the term self-organized has come to be applied to, which in turn describes the flexibility of form by which these spaces mold, incorporate, or invent their organizing structures. Differentiation is key to this. Artist-run spaces choose their own form in answer to their own needs and the needs of culture as they see it at a particular time. The question of time, duration, and its relationship to structure and precarity is also at the crux of the problematic issue of artist-run sustainability. If an artist-run space is to sustain itself, more often than not, the voluntary roles that brought it into being need to be phased out, as voluntary labour is unsustainable in many models. If voluntary labour is removed, funding or revenue streams are required to replace it. And to a large degree, if funding is applied, a new level of bureaucracy and a familiar organisational structure is generally insisted upon. There lies the catch-22 of duration and the artist's run. In most cases, for an artist-run space to be sustainable, it needs to homogenise its structure, phase out artists in the hands-on running of the space, and then appoint a director, curator, and administrator, while artists may retain some oversight or advisory role. It would be interesting to look at the number of non-institutional artists-initiated spaces to discover how much of this was led from inside the organisation and how much was suggested or insisted upon by outside structures. To succeed in duration stakes, artist-run spaces have often had to cease to exist as artist-run. By current metrics, a successful artist-run space is one that grows up to become an institution. As noted in Institutions by Artists, the failure of the self-determination paradigm became apparent once artists no longer seemed to have control over the institutions they created, a position predicted by A.A. Bronson in The Humiliation of the Bureaucrat, Artist-Run Centres as Museums by Artists. The issue of representation, recognition, and visibility of artist-run spaces and their contributory value rather than marketing visibility is tied into the question of what artist-run spaces add to our culture. In Self-Organized, Anne Zephyr Carlson points to the growing number of books and seminars showing an active engagement with the historicization of the artist-run field by the very same people involved in it, suggesting, quote, an absence of competing accounts has allowed the practitioners to write themselves into history, ironically often employing the same strategies as their institutional cousins, end quote. One might ask the question, if not us, then who? An example being Gabriel Deter and Maurizio Nannucci's Artist-Run Spaces, which had its genesis in Zona Archives Florence, of which Nannucci was co-founder, and gathers together extensive research and international pioneering examples vital to a broader understanding of contemporary art practice and its indebtedness to alternative artist-run spaces. Deterer and Nannucci's suggestion, however, that spaces today are run with the primary goal of marketing emerging artists is unfortunate and it ignores the reality of the disparate, non-commercial, communal actions and discursive self-determination that exists within an admittedly different scene, one that crosses over with the commercial and the institutional, but by no means desires as a whole to be assimilated into the status quo. If anything, it perpetuates the idea of the artist-run space as a stopgap where artists hope to find eventual commercial or critical reward without affording much value to what alternative spaces offer in today's increasingly commercial art world. It is the intention of this publication to reach out to the field, to exchange accumulated knowledge in the area of the artist's run, to encourage and facilitate discourse, collaboration, connections, and make a case for the alternative. Over a number of years of research, what has become a wide-ranging and extensive study began with a number of questions, or one obstacle and one big question. The obstacle was a lack of information on artist-run spaces in general, and the difficulty in determining and locating spaces in other countries, something which we felt was a barrier to discourse, collaboration, and the understanding of these spaces and the broader field. The second part was the big question, which was of particular relevance to Palace in nearing 20 years in operation. How does an artist-run space sustain itself and continue to be artist-run? A further impetus was the many instances over the years of other groups and spaces approaching us for advice on how our model has been sustained and developed. We intend that the book will give an insight into not only the workings of PPS, but a range of models, ideas, and applied knowledge. Artists Run Europe has been written in collaboration with a number of artists run and artists initiated spaces, projects, initiatives, and authors. Jason E. Bowman's essay reflects on Midwest project towards the development of an artist-led infrastructure focusing on non-art-making aspects of practice. We have a text by A.A. Bronson, who looks at the development of Art Metropole through to the development of, or he looks back at the development of artist-run spaces in the 1800s in Germany and the thriving art scene, in artist-led art scene in Berlin. And we have case studies then by the likes of short case studies and then longer case studies by the likes of Catalyst Arts and Transmission and other organizations throughout Europe like Supermarket, Art Space. I think there's 8 short ones and 3 large ones. There's an interview with Gavin Wade, who is one of the co-directors of the East Side Project in Birmingham, who, as it happens, have an artist-led symposium on today, the Artist-Led Multiverse, at which Gavin Murphy, my co-director, is giving a talk on something similar to this. A major part of the publication is an expansive and detailed directory of artist-run spaces in Europe, featuring spaces from 37 countries. It attempts to give a sense of the extent of the artist run. While accepting it gives only a momentary sense of the artist-run presence, it provides an idea of the level of activity and acts as a resource for contact collaboration throughout Europe. So each country was researched over a 4-year period, and we tried to find as many artist-run organizations as we could, and we identified them according to categories. The fields here denote whether what type of organizational structure they are and whether they still exist and when they were founded, and then the text at the end is kind of their mission statement. It is important to remember that artist-run spaces are at their core, in the words of Jason E. Bowman, they circumnavigate the market-driven art world and are in essence an alternative. And whether these spaces fail in their intention or not is not really the point, but the fact that artist-run spaces set up themselves as an alternative to the established norms is both important and necessary for our culture. Excuse me. So now I'm going to look at some of the case studies that are in the book, and I'll start with the one that's most familiar to me, which is my own organization, Palace Studios. So Palace Studios set up in the building on the left there back in 1996. It was set up out of the need to provide a place for myself and others to have studios and to just have a kind of a peerage, a place to work together on your own project or in conjunction with others, or even the whole idea of information sharing was very important to it, and it's kind of something to lead on from the peerage that you have whilst in college. So that was kind of the initial modus. After a couple of years, we started to put on exhibitions whereby we take down maybe 6 to 8 of the studios and set up, a kind of a corral of white walls whereby we could install group exhibitions. And that we did about 4 of those until the landlord told us we couldn't do them anymore. And all the time we were lobbying the local council for the provision of studio spaces, because it was in their plan, but they weren't necessarily delivering on it. But after a while, a kind of an interim compromise was offered to us in terms of occupying some of the flats in this block of social housing that was scheduled for demolition. It's in a very deprived area of Dublin with a lot of social deprivation, and it was a lot of heroin addiction, and a lot of people died from those apartments. So when we moved in, they weren't in great condition, but the residents that remained were very happy for us to move in because we provided a bit of life and energy. So we took on the 3 of these apartments here, and then our neighbour was there, and then we had another apartment here. We used 2 apartments. Each apartment had 2 bedrooms and 1 kind of sitting room kitchen. So we used 2 apartments for 6 studios, and then the other 2 apartments were used for kind of alternating exhibitions where one exhibition could be developed whilst in situ, whilst another one was showing, and often we had a kind of an overlap where 2 exhibitions were showing at the same time. And we offered the spaces to artists. We offered them the keys, and they could go and work to their own schedule and according to however long they needed. This artist was working in situ for 6 weeks before his show opened, and he was the first one to use that apartment. So he had to strip it back to the bare walls, and he wanted it that way so he could draw directly onto it. This and most of the shows, there was 18 in all, but of them, I think there was 15 solo shows and 3 group shows. This is Brendan Early in 2003. He was kind of riffing on the idea of, it's 2003, we're not living on the moon, and the modernist project, social housing, that would have kind of mushroomed in Ireland around the time of the release of the 2001 Space Odyssey film, had come and gone. And this project, he was making a comment on that by installing the monolith in one of the bedrooms, and you viewed it through an eye hole, but it also kind of created a camera obscura which projected the monolith into the room beside it, quite faintly. Vanessa O'Reilly was commenting on the idea of the swarm, the arrival of people to a place and then the dissipation. this is Claudia Moe's project. In terms of programming for this is the first venue where we got an opportunity to program in advance, whereas, where we could do one show after another. But we could only really program maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months in advance, because we were told that it was an uncertain amount of time by DCC, and that they would eventually kick us out, and they would give us a month, maybe 3 months notice. And as it turned out, they gave us 3 months notice, but we had kind of grown in confidence with our programming, so we had actually programmed 4 shows for the entire year. So what we had to do was vacate all of the apartments. We had to vacate them anyway, so we got the artists who had studios to vacate a little bit early and had the 4 shows running concurrently and opening on the same night. So it was a nice way to say goodbye to the place. And that's it getting torn down. So as mentioned in the previous slides, as a consequence of our programming in Palace Heights, we got invited to program in the Hugh Lane, which is the municipal gallery. They had taken down a collection as part of a refurb. They were building a new wing to the gallery, so they had to take down all the old masters that they had. So we got access to 5 of the ground floor galleries and the sculptural hall. So we were able to, you know, work to a completely different size budget, like by a factor of 10 or more, maybe a factor of 30. So we were able to like bring our over artists that we encountered from abroad. Like I met Abigail Reynolds in at her Goldsmith show. We had artists from Brazil, from Germany, lots of artists from Ireland as well. Like, cause we were very conscious of what a museum show would represent to young artists. So we kind of tried to spread the opportunity out to as many as we could feasibly. And also within that, we were kind of critical of how the museum's opening hours don't really suit its it doesn't really suit audiences. It doesn't really suit people who work, because the museum closes at 5 o'clock and people finish work at 5 o'clock, you know. And on Saturdays and Sundays, okay, they have their days off, but people have busy schedules on their days off, you know. So I think it's a problem that the museum should really be open till 8 or 9, you know. This museum in question is a city museum, so it's city staff, unionized. So we had to negotiate having two late nights where we could put on live art and music events. So that was interesting for them, like, so because the music went from say like soft choral pieces at the start of the day to banging techno at the end of the day, and like with avant-garde pieces in between, and then lots of different performances. So it was quite the cabaret, and we had two of them. So following that, following the end of Palace Heights, which was a location that was so highly loaded, like in terms of its content and its location, and even if you tried to ignore it, you couldn't, you know, in some way the location would creep into the work. So we looked to try and find the notional white cube, like, what we found in the end was this building, which was kind of maybe as long as this gallery, is as long, maybe a little bit longer, but much narrower, and had a low ceiling. So it was this really, really, you know, instructive sort of cuboid that's 5 times longer. So it really kind of told artists, like, you must do this, you must do that. In a way, it was kind of, it wasn't neutral at all. Like, I mean, the white cube isn't neutral, but this one was really not neutral. This is an artist from America who lived in Ireland for a good number of years. It's a piece called Synchro Materialism, where he traces a line of influence or connections between objects and artifacts, starting with the Degenerate Art exhibition and some Dada posters, and running around the gallery, going through the whole 20th century and then back around. Like, so that was a very successful work, I thought. A part of our makeup is to be interested in collaborating and working with other people, you know. It's a real lifeblood for the organization, where you get to work with other people and other ideas and other energies, and it really is something that we were always interested from the off. And our first one was with Catalyst Arts up in Belfast, but then it kind of like we try to do one or two every year, and I think it's a really important part of like the artist-led culture, is that creating networks and the opportunities to share and exhibit. This is a piece in conjunction with the Artists Association, or the Architecture Association of Ireland, as part, it was a kind of an off-site part of an exhibition that we're running in our new space. It's called A Periodic Review. And this is an example of a collaboration with a kind of a curator-led space in Limerick City. This is Ormiston House. And Ormiston House, interestingly, had negotiated with the city to buy this building off. It was owned by the National Assets Management Agency, which was set up after the crash to kind of work through all of the bad debt and all of the bad properties. And they had arranged with the city to buy it, but then NAMA sold it to a vulture fund, you know, just as they had the contracts laid out. Everything was signed, everything was delivered to the stage where they just needed the signature. The money was in place, and it got sold to a property Vulture Fund, and they won't sell it back to them because it's an old department store, and there's another section on the other side of that wall, so they want to sell it as a single kind of premise, but they can only afford to buy one side, so it's a bit of a disaster. So we moved to another space now, and after the crash, our finances went through the floor. We lost 70% of our kind of Arts Council funding, but at the same time, property also crashed, so we were able to find a really, really great space for our operations, where we were able to have the gallery and the studios together, and it was at, you know, crash prices, so the two things kind of worked themselves out, so we were able to survive for a number of years, but we had to begin to put on artist auctions to kind of keep us covered every 2 years to bring in finance. And this is one of the shows that we started in the space before we moved in here, but it's called the Periodical Review. We invite two other curators to join, myself and Gavin, as curators for the show, and the idea is it's kind of like a magazine show where you review works that you've seen over the course of the year, and you go out like looking at work with an eye to seeing what really kind of stimulates you. You know, it's a kind of a subjective experience. It's not about creating a thematic. It's about creating kind of a subjective experience of the year, and then we try to rehang the works in some way. You know, depending on whether it's a possible or appropriate. You know, like for instance, if it was a large installation, we might ask for something else that related to that work. You know, so this is the one we did in 2016. For this one, myself and Gavin stepped back, and we invited four curators to look at 20 years of practice because we were 20 years old at that time. So That was quite an onerous task, because you know that you're looking back at pre-digital and pre-internet time, you know, where you know stuff exists as memory, and you know, like black and white documents, and you know, like faxes, like what we were talking about last night, you know, disappearing. So we had the director of the Irish Museum of Modern Art, Jenny Houghton, who set up the Sculpture Society of Ireland, and Brian Duggan, who was the original co-founder of a palace. And Declan Long, who is a professor at the National College of Art and Design, selected this one. And then last year, we had a collaborative team. They're called Rachel Gilborn and Kate Strain, Rachel Gilborn. And they selected a bunch of artists, but one of the selections they made was also a collaborative pair who created the structure that we hung the whole show on, which is, you can see it there. So they created the framework for, and that's based on an artist from America, Ken Isaac, from the 60s, who made this kind of a system for living. Like, as part of that exhibition, we try and engage the schools in our local area. Like, because when we moved to the south side, in a particular, it's a different part of the city, but it's still very working class, but there's an awful lot of schools there, and we got a 10-year lease there, so it completely changed how you can think about how as an artist organization you can affect your locality, you know. So we thought it'd be really good to try and get the school groups in and show them that what artists do when they're not kind of showing in museums. You know, it's a different criteria altogether. And then for this year, we're running a program of shows which are short run every 2 weeks. We got like 12 shows every 2 weeks. It was an open submission process, and we do ancillary events or talks. In this case, the artist which you see sitting there, he had a show earlier in the year, but it was in the summer, and he's also an art teacher. So he brought his art class to come and critique Sybil Montague's work, who also works in plaster, but they work in plaster in very different ways, so it was quite interesting. And there's also quite a number of performances that happen, but this year this was a performance as part of Elle Bertilnason and Ulla Juska's exhibition. This is another kind of solo show. They're mostly solo shows, but occasionally there's a pairing. Okay. Back to the cards. So I'd like to go on and talk about some of the other artist-led organizations that are in the book. So this is Triangle France, It was created in New York in 1982 by the collector Robert Loder and the sculptor Anthony Caro. 25 artists for 2 weeks in a rural upstate New York, along with a few thinking heads such as Clement Greenberg and Michael Fried. Since then, the model spread all over the world, where permanent studio programs emerged in Johannesburg in 91, at Gasworks London, in Kenya, Marseille, Brazil, India, Cape Town, and Pakistan. The spread of the Triangle Network has continued with Triangle workshops and residencies taking place in over 40 countries to date, with over 30 affiliated organizations currently active. The first Triangle workshop in Marseille in 1995 created the impetus to allocate the Friche Belle de Mai, a former tobacco factory owned by the government, for new cultural tenants. Triangle France successfully proposed a new residency program to bring selected artists, overseas artists, to Marseille, as well as providing opportunities for Marseille-based artists both at home and abroad. Triangle France made the decision to involve a curator to lead the organization with artists on the board. 20 years later, Triangle France is still based in La Friche, La Belle de Mai, and faithful to its DNA, the organization runs an internationally renowned open submission residency program with high quality studios accommodation, as well as an ambitious curatorial program. Selection is based on the quality of work alone and often brings artists to Marseille who would never be able to come otherwise. Members organizations with management by rotating board, such as Transmission, Catalyst Arts, 126, and the oldest of these, Gallery 54. These tend to be multidisciplinary collectives with a relentless flow of co-directors, artists, members, friends, family that really engage a community of contributors, with reputations as spaces which embrace experimentation and artist risk. They are forever young as the operational model board rejuvenates every 2 years. However, their institutional memory is very short, so as a consequence, the program directors need to find their feet quickly. They tend to be a hub for recent graduates and a nexus of emergent practices. Their ever-changing committees are pre-elected towards high-speed, multifaceted programming output, live events, gigs, screenings, dinners, readings, and performances, offering a way private and public spaces can be accessed and altered through artistic use. Unsurprisingly, these affiliations act as an aperture to hybridize underground culture are cemented through artist-led exchanges. An early exchange between Transmission in Glasgow led to the Catalyst Arts being constituted in Belfast, Northern Ireland, in 1994. Both of these organisations were highly influential in Ireland and the UK and were of special inspiration to Palace when it was setting up. The model has spread to many other orgs in Ireland, such as 126 in Galway, Platform Arts in Belfast, and others. Catalyst organises Fix, one of Europe's longest-running live art performance biennials. And that's Transmission Glasgow. Pink Cube is an intimate, non-profit space with a pink wall paint containing bodily fluids. Artist and director Anya Carr started Pink Cube in 2011 with an aim to create a space with a good gender balance that challenged the idea of the white cube as a neutral and ideal space for art. All the exhibitions at Pink Cube are art battles between two artist groups. This dual format aims to boost fruitful artistic dialogue across genders and generations and gives artists the opportunity to test their artistic strengths in a new way. The battle exhibition usually lasts 1 to 3 weekends and include up-and-coming as well as established artists working with all kinds of media. For battle 11, Yana Thule Jewel filled the space with 2 tons of hay, and for battle 13, Bard Ask created paintings containing sperm. Previous battles include artists from Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Australia, Israel, Brazil, Scotland, Canada, Germany, and USA. For each battle, Carr invites artists that have some common interests but can challenge each other in a different way. The planning and mounting of the works is a collaboration between the director and the exhibitors. A group of 4 to 6 artists works as volunteers at the opening events. The concept of the space can be moved as long as the walls are painted with the same unique pink paint. So Eastside Projects, it was set up as an artist's public-run gallery where the whole process is considered to be an artwork. They're based in Birmingham, 2008. So as part of the book, we've asked all of the organizations who've done a case study to break out what their particular structures were, you know, and this is kind of the breakdown of Eastside projects. They produced user manuals to stimulate how the public used the organization. So that the whole process is considered to be an artwork. And they've declared that they are not making art for the public, but that they are the public making art. So that's kind of an interesting turnaround, you know? And they find that the agencies accept that, which is good. They're kind of like the VTO, like the vertical takeoff of artist-run spaces, as they were initiated with a high level of government funding and with some serious ambitions to match it. And they have a very interesting program called ESP, it's Extra Special People Program, which is about kind of volunteers and interns plugging in, but they get to generate program. A lot of it happens off-site, you know, so they're quite an interesting organization. And as I say, they're having the artist multiverse on today, which is a sleepover with organizations from all over. The Vienna Secession is the world's oldest independent exhibition space explicitly dedicated to contemporary art. It was established in 1897 and continues to operate today as an institution run by artists. It occupies a unique position in the history of modern art, combining a contemporary forward-looking program with a building whose architecture is an icon of the spirit of the imminent change around 1900. The Association of Visual Artists Vienna Secession was founded by the group of artists who had split off from the conservative Kunsthallerhaus. Their leader, Gustav Klimt, became the first president of the association. Other founding members included the architect Josef Maria Ulbricht. Ulbricht directed the planning for an exhibition hall in close collaboration with the other artists to create Gesamtkunstwerk that embodied the group's new vision, to every time its art, to art its freedom. The program of 10 to 15 shows a year is put together in a democratic process by the association's 13-member board and based exclusively on artistic criteria. The succession has almost 400 regular members, working artists and architects, from whose ranks the board of directors and the president are elected to 2-year terms of office. In keeping with the radicalism of its founding fathers, the Secession today hosts an international program that explores current forms of artistic expression in solo and themed exhibitions. The building's architecture, and especially the main gallery, which is often referred to as the very first white cube, still provides excellent conditions for today's artistic practices. The HDLU is another artists' association. It's the Croatian Association of Artists, whose building has had a checkered history. The building was conceived as a gallery of living visual art by sculptor-architect Ivan Mestrovic as a tribute to King Peter, rather than a statue of a horse with a natty figure on it. It was to house the Croatian Association of Artists and to run shows of contemporary art. However, when the fascists took over shortly after it was built in the 30s, they annexed it and turned it into a mosque, as you see in the top corner there. Following the war, the communists turned it into a museum of revolution. Finally, it was returned to its original purpose when Croatia achieved independence in the early 90s. Whilst delivering a talk in Delft at a Cree Art conference on creative collaborations organized by ID11 for the Cree Art Network, which is a pan-European funded project with organizations from 12 different countries, from city councils to artist-led organizations. I met Josip Sanki, the president of the HDLU. This led to a collaboration between his organization, Palace, and Difference Engine, which is an artist collaborative group based in Dublin, of which I'm a member. So, Josip curated a show and sent it to Dublin. It was a show of like four artists of four different generations of Croatia. This is Antun Maricic, whose project was called Nograd and its surrealism. The town in question here is Nogradiska, and he was there after a period of bombing, and he kind of walked around whilst it was kind of hazy, and he just felt that it was like no longer a city, like it was beyond that, it was somewhere in between, surreal. And we brought, our collaborative group, Difference Engine, brought an exhibition to HGLU, which is inside the Round Barrel Gallery. So there's five of us in the show, but there's four of us in the show, but only three of us traveled. So this is kind of my work here. Gillian's got a painting. Wendy has a large kind of 2x3 meter photograph, and then some sculptures on the floor. It's a view from above. Some people in it. And whilst on my way home from that conference in Delft, I met an artist in at the airport, just at the same terminal. She was living in Rotterdam, but she was on her way back to Dublin. And she had been an intern at Palace, a volunteer, and had shown with us. And she'd set up a group studio, like just a small space, and occasionally they'd done exhibitions. So it was kind of interesting to see it from two different sides, like from an institution that's been going for 150 years to something that's quite ad hoc and only just set up. So we talked about doing a show, and our previous show to this had been in a museum in Limerick, which had been quite disparate. You know, it was big. We'd spread out, and our kind of modus is like how works can overlap, and new works can be created by the conjunction of two different artists' work. So we were looking for a space that was much smaller, and they had this shower room where they were thinking that they would like to use it at some point, because they had another room, but they also had a shower room. So we elected to show in the shower room. And this is the work. There is a combination of Gillian Lawler's work with mine, and mine's underneath it as well. So I'm showing these pieces at the end to just kind of show the importance of actually continuing to work as an artist whilst running an artist run organization. I think it can be important to try and, you know, somehow fight for your own time to be able to make your own work, as well as do all of the various, or adhere to the various demands that running an organization asks of you. So that's the end of my talk. So if you have any questions, you know. Thank you.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hi, my name is Sindri. Thank you so much for your talk. I do not have like a articulate question, but I would like to ask you, you know, to talk a little bit about, because I thought it was so fascinating, the picture that you showed about the apartment building just being completely torn down after you've been using it. And you talked a little bit about the other transitions, but not so much about what happened to the other houses where you were situated out of these seven locations.
Seven, right? Locations, yeah.
So, I mean, could you talk about the gentrifying aspect of the artist run?
Yeah. I don't necessarily think that we were like involved in a gentrifying process per se, really, because we were kind of those flats have been torn down and they've rebuilt them, and they've just provided new social housing for same sector of society. So in that regard, those particular apartments had well gone by their sell-by date. You know, if you might have read on the slide, we had to decommission one of the rooms because there's this kind of slimy mold, and we had ears, like mushroom ears growing on the windows, and our neighbor was living in this situation, which was really, really awful. And she'd been there for many, many years, but she was kind of on a list for maybe 8 years to be moved out. But yes, it was kind of a necessity to kind of renew the accommodation for the social housing, but it's not done at the correct pace at all. But what they did they just built very uninteresting housing. They didn't make anything. The original plan was to have a swimming pool on the ground floor level and then have quite an interesting development of social housing, but they didn't do that. They just did something quite bland. And now in our new place, it could be suggested that we're part of a gentrifying process, but I think it's different. I think it's the fact that artist-run spaces move to the edge of where, as close as they can be to the centre, and it's not necessarily that they're gentrifying. It's happening anyway, you know. But they're trying to be closer to the centre, and I've kind of always thought about this. Like, perhaps if artist-run spaces don't want to be kind of moved out and, you know, moved on every 5 years or what, they should move very far away from the centre, you know. So this is a debate we're having at the moment, because we've got 4 years left in our lease, but from soon 3 years after we started our lease, we started looking at plans to how we would be able to continue beyond our lease, because we figured that the landlord won't give us a renewal, because we're in a part of the city. It's a very old part of the city, but it didn't get developed in the previous boom, but it's happening now. Like, there's a hotel going in beside us. There's a 5-star hotel went in behind us. A whole square which had a food co-op, a community food co-op, and a flea market. They've all been kicked out, and you know, it's all been getting redeveloped. And you know, the city kind of says it's great to have these sort of organizations like a flea market and a food market and artist-run organizations. It's great to have them operating, but they don't really care if they're not. You know what I mean? Really, you know, they don't. It's very hard to kind of. It's very hard to kind of enforce them to go by the text of their plans, you know. Like, we lobbied really hard. They rewrite their plan every 5 years, and and you can make submissions. So all of the 50% of the artist-run spaces, artist studios, not artist-run spaces, but 50% of the studios were closed down during the after the crash, you know, maybe 3 years after it started, and that was an audit done by the Dublin City Council. So there's probably a lot more than that, you know. So the remaining studios and some of the studios that did get closed down came together as a collective, and we lobbied hard with DCC and we made submissions. And as a consequence of that, they've put in a provision in the planning that 2% of any development over a certain size has to go towards working space for culture, you know. So not just display spaces. So that's good, but that only came out last year. So how that kind of gets inculcated into their processes can take time, you know, but it has changed in some places. Like, for instance, that development behind us, they had to change their plans and put in 4 units for studios, you know. But we're trying to also argue that maybe it wouldn't be so good to have 4 studios here, 2 here, 1 there, you know, all dotted around, that it might be better to bring them all together and have permanent spaces for you know, for cultural provision, because it's kind of siloing, and you know, you're creating that community rather than having lots of disparate elements.
Thank you. I think we have a little bit to watch time, but any.
Hi. My name is Unnar. Maybe just if you could elaborate on this relationship between the studio and then this kind of artist run, whatever it is, community, you know, gallery, you know, this. How does that go together? The studio practice, yeah, versus the, you know, exhibiting, you know, curating, you know, all that kind of management that goes on with that. And is that's been a part of your kind of...
Are you talking about for me?
Yeah, that's been a part of your project since the beginning, right?
Yeah.
The studio and this kind of the exhibition space. Could you elaborate a little bit on that and that kind of...
Yeah, so we initiated as studios, and when we decided to start doing programming, we kind of kept the studios separate, you know. Because the studios are, there's no barrier to entry other than you wanting to make art, you know. So we don't, like, we just, anybody can join the studios, and we'd always had that, and that model, and the only way we would ask you to leave is if you weren't using your space, you know, that was kind of the model. So, but occasionally we'd do exhibitions where we'd ask all of the studio artists to show in them, but they're few and far between. So then myself and Gavin curate shows, but most of the shows we curate are where we invite artists and we give them kind of free rein, you know. It's like, we invite them because we like their work, we have faith in them, we have trust, and generally over the years it's been like, we'll support you, but you know, it's your thing. You're like, we want to kind of have that kind of notion of you know, them taking complete ownership of it, you know. So then all the while, separately working in my own studio, making my own work, and you know, trying to do shows of my own thing. And then a number of years ago, I set up a working group with, we set up a working group, Difference Engine. And the idea behind Difference Engine was, we had similarities of processes, similarities of interests, but weren't the same, you know. But the idea was to kind of set up a group of artists that would work together to put on exhibitions that would be experimental, that would play around with exhibition design and how things go together. But the primary motivation was that it would create a kind of a support structure whereby we could generate many shows. And the shows themselves are places where experiments can happen, and there's kind of a looseness that you can bring to it. It's quite different than doing a solo show, you know, where you have to really agonize over every single decision. But when you're in a more playful environment where you're like pushing your work up against somebody else's work, you know, whether it works or not, it changes, you know what I mean? You're not so precious about every single decision. And as a consequence, like, we've had 11 shows to date in since 2007, so it's being very generative, you know. And those works can be kind of ripped out and brought into a kind of a solo context, you know, in a different way, yeah. And then for Palace, we don't tend to have shows where myself and Gavin will be in them. You know, it'd be mostly other artists, you know. Yeah. Does that answer the question, or do? Yeah.
And I was wondering, what are these artist-led spaces, what can they offer, or what are they offering that the institutional art exhibitions and museum spaces are not or cannot offer to the audiences and to the locality?
Well, they're offering access to artists doing things in a different way than museums would, you know. The artist-led kind of might have a faster turnover of exhibition. They have a different type of event. They have a different level of accessibility than the institutions would have for artists, you know. So there's more. So by that merit, by that regard, the community can experience different valences of artist production. And I think it can be like, for the likes of, say, Transmission, Catalyst, 126, particularly those bodies, where the activity is very frenetic, and it happens, it doesn't happen too far in advance, you know. They decide, they do it, it happens. Museums go do studio visits, they think about it, they develop relationships with artists. You have a studio visit, your exhibition mightn't happen for 2 years, you know. And with our open submission process, we were kind of looking at that and kind of going, well, you know, a lot of artists have work that they want to show it, and they want to see how, they want to test it by showing it, you know. So we offer that sort of space for that to happen. Whereas a museum comes in kind of later, an institution comes in later, I think, where the work has been tested already, you know. So in terms of the community, they see a different type of art, I guess, you know, for different at a different stage or different energy, you know.
Okay. Thank you, Mark.